people find it hard to believe that someone would confess, period, much less confess to a murder, period, much less confess to the murder of a loved one. And in Daryl Parker's case, like in so many of these, he confessed to killing his wife.
Feeling lost?
Then you're in the right place.
I'm Amanda Knox.
And I'm Christopher Robinson.
And this
is False Confessions,
a Labyrinths miniseries.
Lincoln, Nebraska, 1955. A recent graduate of Iowa State, Daryl Parker, comes home on his lunch break to find his wife dead. She'd been beaten, her hands and feet were bound. She'd been raped and strangled to death. Parker called the police, distraught. After burying his wife a few days later, the police brought him into a windowless room. There, a former cop and polygraph expert named John Reed hooked Parker up to the polygraph. And as Parker answered questions, Reed told him the machine indicated he was lying. He then introduced Parker to an alternate story, that Parker's marriage was unhappy, that his wife refused to provide the sex he was rightfully due, that she was flirtatious with other men. After 9 hours of this, Parker finally confessed that in a fit of rage, he had raped and killed his wife.
That confession solidified Reed's reputation, and his name and psychological technique became synonymous with effective police work.
It was first developed here in Chicago, actually at Northwestern University, in the 1950s.
That's Laura Nyreiter, false confessions expert and former co-director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth at Northwestern University, the same place where Reed developed his method.
And these are psychological interrogation techniques. That's what we call them. They work on your psychology, the way you understand the world, your incentives, right? What should I be doing in this moment? You know, is this person friend or foe? All of those sort of psychological games. When they were invented, what had been in place before then was physical abuse. People would be like hung outside of windows or beaten in order to get confessions and statements out of them. These techniques were thought of as so revolutionary and enlightened at the time because, well, they weren't physical torture. A lot of these techniques that we're talking about were lifted from the old school high pressure sales tactics, like door-to-door salesmen, right? Like, act now, I'm only going to be sitting in this interrogation room with you for the next hour, and if I leave, then the price of your not cooperating is going to go up by 20 years, you know? But everybody thought they were fantastic at the time. Isn't this great? And the psychological techniques were packaged and sold and marketed by a company here in Chicago to our police around the country. And they were told this is the way to get confessions, and they were told these techniques are foolproof, right? And it's going to work, and you'll get the statement.
There are 9 steps to the Reed interrogation method, but it's important to look at what precedes it. As Saul Kassin explains in his book, Duped, there are 2 pillars of the Reed method that have informed American-style interrogation broadly. The first is an information-gathering interview that is meant to be neutral rather than presumptive of guilt.
John E. Reed and Associates calls this the Behavioral Analysis Interview, or BAI. It's rooted in Reed's work with the polygraph dating back to the 1940s. Here's how Joseph B. Buckley, the current president of Reed and Associates, describes it.
Our initial contact with the subject, unless there's some life-saving circumstance involved, should be a non-accusatory, non-confrontational interview.
The BAI features a set of behavior-provoking questions.
Questions we know from experience and from research that most truthful people answer one way, most deceptive people answer a different way.
Reed training also teaches interrogators to look for a set of behavioral symptoms as indicators of deception.
This is also a time when the interrogators try to put the suspect at ease, as Steve Drizin, director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions, explains.
There's a brief period of rapport building to sort of make the suspect feel comfortable. And after the suspect has an opportunity to tell his or her side of the story, there's a break, and the interrogators leave the room for some period of time.
Here, if the result of the BAI is that the interrogator believes the suspect is lying, the Reed method shifts into the second pillar, the 9 steps of interrogation.
And then they come back in and it's like a switch has been flipped and it becomes accusatory almost immediately, confrontational. They say to the suspect, look, we're not here to talk about whether or not you're guilty. We already know that. We've been working this case for months. There's material that's sent to the lab that we know is going to come back and link you to the crime. You know, they make the suspect believe that resistance is futile. And this can happen over a course of hours.
This is the first step of the Reed method, engaging in a positive confrontation. You saw this in all the cases we've talked about so far.
Like, you're lying, you're not telling the truth.
And then comes Polanco again, yelling at me, you're lying, you're not telling me something.
He looked at me and said, Mr. Lowry, my test is showing me that you're lying.
Then it's on to step two, developing a theme.
The Reed technique then suggests that you provide psychological themes to the suspect, a face-saving explanation for why they might have committed the crime. It could be a moral or a legal explanation for why they committed the crime. Legal explanations would be things like, you didn't mean to kill this person. This was something that was spontaneous, not deliberate. She consented to having sex with you. She was wearing skimpy clothes. If I were in your position, I would have read those signals the same way.
Typically, the investigator attempts to shift some of the blame for what the subject did onto some person or set of circumstances other than the suspect himself, building the subject up as a good, honest, hardworking person who made a mistake in judgment due to his friend talking him into it, the financial pressures he was facing, etc.
Then they turn, they say, you know, I think you're a good person. I understand, I'm sympathetic. You were under a lot of pressure. I might have done the same thing under your circumstances. It's probably not something you intended to do. Maybe it was an accident. Maybe you were provoked. Maybe you had one too many drinks. I get it. Well, I'm not saying, therefore, if you confess, you get to go home, but it sure as hell is implied. And research study after research study after research study has shown that when people read or hear or watch minimizing remarks like that, they infer leniency as if an explicit promise of leniency had been made.
Step three is handling denials by interrupting and redirecting a suspect's claims of innocence. We covered that last episode.
I looked at a case recently where the suspect vehemently, adamantly denied 63 times and then finally caved. Well, of course, what else was she supposed to do? She wants to get out of there, and it's pretty clear that with these assertions, it's not happening.
According to the Reed & Associates publication, Criminal Interrogation and Confessions, 5th edition, an innocent person will not allow such denials to be cut off. A guilty person usually will cease to voice a denial, or else the denials will become weaker, and he will submit to the investigator's return to a theme.
Or as Joseph Buckley put it in an official Reed training video,
many guilty people introduce their denials with permission phrases, such as, can I say one thing? Would you just listen to me? But sir, if I could only explain. When the interrogator hears those phrases, it's important to interject yourself and stop the person from continuing, because if you let him talk, he'll say the words, I didn't do it. And the more often a person says they didn't do it, the more difficult it becomes for us to get a confession.
Step four is overcoming objections. If the suspect asserts any reasons why they would not or could not commit the crime, the interrogator counters with reasons why they know the suspect is lying. Here's false confessions expert Richard Leo.
They might appeal to their experience. They might appeal to their superior knowledge. They might appeal to logic or plausibility.
They then redirect the suspect back to the theme established in step two, that the crime was an accident, for example, or that it was morally, if not legally, justified.
Step five is retaining the subject's attention. This is done by invading the suspect's personal space.
And they also put interpersonal pressure. Sometimes they move closer, raise their voice, tell a suspect it's now or never.
Step 6, handling the suspect's mood. Here, the interrogator gauges if the suspect is passive enough to confess. If the answer is yes, they move on to step 7, the alternative question.
When the subject appears ready to tell the truth, when they've made the decision to tell us what they've done, the easiest way to open that door is through the use of what's called an alternative question. Johnny, was this the first time you did something like this, or has it happened many times before?
Essentially, the interrogator asks a question where one of the alternatives is more excusable than the other. Choosing the more acceptable option seems like a way out, but both options are actually incriminating. In my case, they presented the scenario to me that I was witness to the murder. That's what I ended up confessing to in the statements I was coerced into signing. But by placing myself at the scene of the crime as a witness, they were able to argue that I participated in the murder, and even that I was the ringleader of the supposed murder orgy.
If you're broken down and you don't know what to do next, and they offer you this escape hatch, you see the light at the end of the tunnel, you know what? I would have done the same thing. It's no big deal. People often say, okay, where do I sign?
The method wraps up with step 8, obtaining an oral confession, and step 9, converting an oral confession into a written one. The Reed manual even advises interrogators not to put a signature line on the typed-up statement, but merely ask them to sign at the bottom. Because if the suspect refuses to sign the statement, quote, it will look far better without the unused signature line on it. And in that case, the police testimony about the oral confession is often sufficient for a conviction.
And the thing is, the Reed method works. It reliably gets suspects to confess. Whether those confessions are reliable is a trickier question. And this might not matter so much if the method weren't so popular.
These are not rogue cops who are out there freelancing and making up their own stuff. They're following this widely used set of interrogation techniques. It's pretty much by the book, all of these promises that everything is going to be okay as long as you cooperate, fill in the blanks. That's all chapter and verse. A lot of people don't know that police in all 50 states use the same set of interrogation techniques, right? They're trained by one or two companies that really train almost all the cops out there, federal, states, everywhere.
Johnny Reed and Associates now trains more interrogators by far than any other company. As a result, the Reed technique has spread across the world. If John Reed were alive today, he may have been proud to see techniques that he pioneered used to elicit a confession from a scared 20-year-old girl thousands of miles from Chicago, all the way over in Perugia, Italy.
Reed and Associates is proud of the work they do, and on their website, they note that the Reed technique has been cited by the Supreme Court as an example of law enforcement resources that offer proper training regarding Miranda rights. They note that the NSA awarded them a bid to study the use of behavior symptoms in the detection of deception. They say that international research from Japan to Spain has validated core elements of the Reed technique. And they note that they've been awarded training contracts from NATO, and that they've conducted training in dozens of countries, from Singapore to Kenya to Italy.
In short, the Reed technique has been given widespread legitimacy in law and law enforcement on a global scale. So is it any wonder that police around the US still turn to Reed for training and interrogation methods? According to a survey conducted by Reed and Associates, over 99% of confessions obtained using their method were admitted in courts, and 95% of respondents reported that the Reed technique had improved their confession rate.
But what do interrogators think of this technique, and more broadly of what Saul Kassin calls American-style interrogation? What is it like to sit on the other side of that table with a crime to solve?
I ran the 9/11 investigation for the Los Angeles field office. I worked violent crimes. I worked school shootings. I was in charge of Al-Qaeda investigations. I was also in charge of a fly team, the one that, you know, when they say FBI agents are on the way to the bombing in Beirut or wherever it is, I ran one of those rapid response teams.
That's retired FBI Special Agent Steve Moore. You may remember him from episode 16 of Labyrinths, Tales from the G-Man.
I'll say I, as far as the colloquial term, interrogated a lot of people, dozens. I like to think I didn't interrogate anybody. I interviewed people because, with the exception of one or two, I was trying to elicit information. I was trying to learn about the case, about the person, about that I was talking to, and about other people. In an interrogation, you come in and you've already decided. You already know what happened, and you're going after a confession. An interview is you're trying to get information, and an interrogation is you're trying to get a confession. That, to me, is the simplest differentiation between the two.
Got it. Yeah, so let's talk about that distinction. Of the people that I've talked to about interrogations, very often they say that law enforcement officers will say, I'm just interviewing you.
That can happen, but when you start an interview as an interview, if at any point during the interview it becomes clear to you that this person is actually the person who committed the crime, there are things that you have to do. It literally changes the legal standing of the interview. For instance, among the rules I had as an FBI agent is at any time during the interview, whether it's before the interview begins or in the middle of the interview, and you anticipate arresting the person at the end of the interview, you have to stop and you have to, at that point, read them the rights, because now they are no longer a source of information. They are a suspect in the crime. And so if I ever began an interview with you and you were a suspect, I would be required by federal law to advise you of your rights. For anybody who's going through that, if the FBI interviews you and they advise you of your rights before the interview starts, you're a suspect.
But how exactly does it become clear to an interrogator that the person they are questioning is likely guilty?
The interview part of the job was extremely difficult. It was the most challenging thing I did in the FBI. Arrests were easy. This was challenging because if you've got somebody who's good for the crime, it's kind of a psychological game you're playing. It's like trying to pick somebody up at a bar. You know, you don't know how it's going to go, and you could end up very embarrassed. The way I used to like to do an interview is talk to somebody for about 30 minutes, get an idea of how they look when they're relaxed, are their pupils dilated, all this kind of stuff, and then start them, ask them to talk through the whole thing, and then start to talk to them about inconsistencies and see if their pupils dilated, see if they could come up with explanations of how things work. It's when you think, you know what? I'm talking to the guilty party. Certain things have clicked over and you've said, wait a minute, only so-and-so would know that. This guy's the one who did it.
Sure.
But you have to be very careful. And when a law enforcement officer is in an interview and their mind just says, I'm pretty convinced they're guilty, at that point, several things should be happening. You should ask yourself, what makes me think they're guilty? You know, if I think, I'm pretty sure this guy's guilty, I am really sure, but I don't have evidence to prove it, I'm probably not going to read them their rights. Because at that point, they are not a legitimate suspect. My hunch tells me that they're probably good for it, but I can't prove it. And so the interview could possibly continue without reading the rights. That's one issue that's a gray area. And I lost the second most important confession of my life because the Department of Justice felt that I had gone too far in the interview. And when you lose a slam dunk important case because the United States attorney believes that you've gone too far, it resets. It's like somebody threw a penalty flag on you. I don't think I deserve that penalty flag, by the way, and I believe that person should have gone to jail. But it helps you when you're looking across at a defendant who's going to lose a significant portion of their life to jail or worse. And when the judge hands down a sentence, if you as a law enforcement officer who took their statement, don't look inward and say, did I do everything right? Then maybe you should think about something else as a career, because it's important to be fearful and aware of the power that you have.
We decided to talk to Steve Moore specifically because he's a friend of ours, and though we may disagree on some important topics, we know he's ethical and careful, and we wanted to give law enforcement a fair shake. But not all interrogators are interrogating their own instincts, hunches, and conclusions the way Steve did. Take, for example, Detective James McCready, who accused then 17-year-old Marty Tankliff of murdering his parents back in 1988. We'll cover Marty's false confession and wrongful conviction in more depth later. But for now, listen to how Detective McCready stands by his instincts and his actions in this CBS News interview.
How soon did you really start suspecting Marty killed his parents?
Probably within the hour.
But did Marty ever say, you're right, you got me, I did it?
A lot of times, in many, many confessions, you never get 100% of the truth out of a defendant anyway. What happens is they try to minimize their involvement.
Marty Tankliff's wasn't the only wrongful conviction McCready was involved in. From 1975 to 1985, the New York Supreme Court's Appellate Division overturned 10 murder convictions from McCready's department because confessions were obtained using illegal tactics. One defendant claimed he had only confessed after McCready had kicked him in the testicles.
Like in any profession, there's a spectrum of ethics. The question is, are false confessions just the result of bad apples among law enforcement? Or are the problems more systemic?
Could you talk to me about what kinds of techniques have you seen employed or you've heard about employed that do overwhelm the will of the innocent? And what are those techniques that you would say are good interrogation or interview techniques?
Well, one of the most blunt ways of overwhelming the will of an innocent person is to say, you are going to prison for a certain amount of time. I guarantee you that is going to happen. But if you talk to me and admit to this, you won't go to prison for this amount of time. You'll go to prison for this amount of time. And so that worked a lot for years, where a person would legitimately believe, especially from marginalized communities, they have got me, whether I'm guilty or not. So why don't I limit the damage? And Amanda, I'm not saying I have the solution to this, and I'm not saying I want to keep police from using all these techniques. I'm saying that it's something we need to discuss and come to some agreement on. But that's one big one. I think everybody has to come to grips with what they're comfortable with. After those first training interviews where I saw different ways of interviewing, and again, the FBI brought in successful interview agents all the time to talk to you, and they had seminars and stuff, I decided I never wanted to lie. You can confuse the hell out of somebody to the point where they don't know what's up and what's down. That is something that really happens most when you get into sleep deprivation and long, long, long interrogations. That basically is torture light. That is something that doesn't leave a physical mark, but leaves an emotional mark. And those are things that most police departments in the United States could not get away with, I believe and hope. But it's something that was just rampant overseas, and it was terrifying for me.
Of course, lying to suspects is incredibly common here at home, and there are plenty who defend the practice as essential to the job. Here's James McMahon, the policy director with the Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs in Washington State. This is from his testimony before the state legislature earlier this year, opposing a bill that would ban deception by law enforcement.
Sometimes it's an unfortunate reality. We have to lie to people to get them to tell the truth. If we could somehow get people to actually be required to tell us the truth, we wouldn't have to lie. That's just an unfortunate reality of law enforcement. We also lie, frankly, to protect confidential informants. We lie in things like net nanny stings. We lie to protect ongoing criminal investigations. We lie to protect confidential informants, undercover investigations, all of those sorts of things.
I also testified at that very hearing in support of this bill James McMahon was opposing. But I want to acknowledge that it's not an obviously crazy position to take. Dealing with homicides and murder suspects is an incredibly difficult and high-stakes job. Detectives and interrogators are routinely put face-to-face with guilty people who do not want to be found guilty. Confrontation and conflict is inevitable.
There was a guy who was good for an anthrax crime, and nobody had been hurt. He was the worst liar in the whole world. He had told me 10 lies, and each one of them were easily provable. Well, I couldn't get there because I had a car accident, and I sprained my ankle. Oh, good. So show me the car, and let's see what hospital you went to. Oh, well, I didn't leave my name. You mean they treated you without getting a name? You know, stuff like that. I said, do you have any pictures of your son? His son was 12. He had talked about him. And he said, yeah. I said, can I see it? And he showed it to me. And I said, this is a good looking kid. Do you want to go to his high school graduation or his college graduation?
Wow.
Because the next few minutes decide.
Mm-hmm.
I'm embarrassed to say it, but that goes to the first part of the thing I discussed, where you say, I am going to get you. You decide how long. I had already read him his rights. The facts in the matter were easy to prove. But the one thing I didn't have is, you know, I did it. And that one I needed. Once he confessed, then he gave me information that corroborated everything. You know, what number did you call when you called in? So all that corroborated. But to get that initial, yes, I did it, I had to do that.
How do you feel about that?
I feel like I did the right thing in the situation. There's extenuating factors. Lives were being lost on this if we didn't get this guy right away. That's number one. Number two is, if he gave me a confession that we couldn't corroborate it, then I wouldn't have used the confession. So that's as close as I think I've come. I didn't feel corrupt. I wasn't bluffing at all. I knew that there were a lot at stake. And so to me, it's kind of like playing chicken. It's not something I'm proud of, but I got away with it. And by got away, I got the person who did it, and I believe I saved lives. So, I mean, that's strange, but that's sometimes how it feels.
The 9 steps of the Reid technique are designed to lead a guilty suspect to confess. This wouldn't be so much of a problem if those interrogating suspects were able to determine with a good degree of certainty whether a suspect was lying to them. And that is what the Reid training claims to do, to teach investigators how to detect deception during the initial non-confrontational behavior analysis interview by looking for subtle physical and linguistic cues.
The interview contains a number of questions that we're supposed to ask that are supposedly diagnostic, that separates the guilty from the innocent. And equally, what investigators are trained to do is, when you ask those questions, observe closely. Observe the suspect's demeanor. Are they giving you eye contact, or are they looking away? Are they freezing in their posture, or do they remain relaxed? Are they turning away from you, or are they continuing a frontal alignment? And look at their facial expressions. And so the goal is to use various verbal and nonverbal cues to determine, based on these interviews, whether or not the person is telling the truth or lying. In theory, there's nothing wrong with the idea.
Reed and Associates is even quick to dismiss myths such as, if you look up and to the left, that means you're lying. Instead, they tout their more nuanced and sophisticated approach to behavioral analysis.
It's important to remember that there is no behavior unique to deception. Behavior has to be evaluated in both context and against the subject's normal behavioral baseline.
The problem is the science that has followed the development of that technique, and that science now is 30 plus years old. Social psychologists in general learned early on a couple of things. One, we are terrible lie detectors. The average human is 54% accurate, slightly better than flipping a coin. When law enforcement samples are studied, they don't prove to be any better than the average person, only a whole lot more confident, which is dangerous.
However sophisticated Reed's behavior analysis methods are, the research results are clear. In one study that Saul Kassin conducted, a group trained on the Reed method was actually less accurate at telling when a subject was lying, 46%, than the naive control group, which was 56% accurate. The problem was the Reed-trained group rated their confidence in their answers much higher, at 6.5 out of 10. Another study he conducted showed that professional investigators were also more likely to mistake a truth for a lie than the other way around.
You know, when I first read about this pre-interrogation interview, I thought, wow, that's great. They're not just willy-nilly throwing anyone into an interrogation. They're vetting them first.
As John Buckley puts it in a Reed training video,
interrogations should only occur when the case investigative information indicates the subject's probable involvement in the commission of the crime. We're not interrogating people at random.
Yeah, but the vetting process turns out not to be diagnostic of guilt or innocence. Whether it's flipping a coin or slightly better, a lot of mistakes will be made at that point. And the consequence is this. Either they determine that a suspect is telling the truth and send him home, or they determine that the suspect is lying and move them into the interrogation, which is highly guilt presumptive, as proven by the fact that it opens with an accusation of guilt made with certainty. We know you did it. Don't lie to us. I've heard investigators say, it's not guilt presumptive. What? It opens with an accusation of guilt and a rejection of denials. That sounds guilt presumptive to me by definition. So that's the problem with the vetting process. But that's one reason why it's very important that before you toss someone into an interrogation room, in the same way as before you toss a suspect into an eyewitness lineup, you should have some real evidence that that person belongs there. Because otherwise, you're putting that person at risk when there may be no reason for that presumption.
Behavioral analysis can't reliably determine deception. It isn't supported by science. And yet many law enforcement and lay people still believe that micro-expressions and behavioral cues reveal whether a person is being honest or not. Here's interrogation instructor Eric Baum on the Street Cop Training Podcast.
The first thing I do when I walk in and I meet somebody and I see somebody with their arms folded, I know that this person is uncomfortable because we were taught that, you know, that means they're protecting their innards, so to speak.
What's your big one?
Eye movement.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When I'm talking to somebody, if I just see, you know, somebody's eyes, you know, going up, down, left, down, right, that's one of the first things. The other thing is hand movements, leg tapping a little bit. Maybe sometimes I see them covering their mouth when they're answering because they know they're fucking full of shit, you know?
And there are plenty of so-called behavior analysis experts out there peddling this pseudoscience as reliable. Like the Behavior Panel YouTube channel, which analyzed my facial expressions for 3 hours to determine that, of course, I'm deceptive.
So we see the tongue jut there, and the tongue jut typically means either A, a person's worried about their story, are you going to believe it? Or B, I feel great about this, I probably got away with it. And there is no emotion whatsoever here. There's something that should be sad and there's no sadness. Something should be shocking when we see surprise on the eyes. There's something that should be horrifying or scary. We're not seeing it.
One of the other problems with the idea of dividing the questioning of suspects into a neutral information gathering interview and a confession-driven interrogation is that the line between interview and interrogation is often quite blurry.
Police are trained when you interview, you let them do the talking. You don't suggest the answers. You don't direct them. The idea is to gather as much information as you can to advance your investigation and discover the truth.
False confessions expert Dr. Richard Leo.
An interrogation is different because it's only supposed to be for suspects that police have concluded are guilty in their mind. It's designed to confirm their pre-existing beliefs by getting a confession. You could have the question answer that segues into an interrogation. And oftentimes in these false confession cases in particular, you will see polygraphs or the so-called computer voice stress analyzer that are given, which are, you know, pseudoscientific gimmicks that are designed to get a confession but have a lot of valence in our culture. They're just kind of interviews, and then you're strapped to a machine or a computer, and then the police say, well, you're lying, you're guilty. And then that interview and polygraph becomes an interrogation. An interrogation from a legal point of view is when police use words or actions designed to elicit incriminating statements. And that's fine legally without giving Miranda warnings if the person's free to leave. But if they're not free to leave, or a reasonable person would not perceive themselves to be free to leave, and you have custody plus interrogation, then you're entitled to Miranda warnings and there should be a Miranda waiver. So an interview would be different in that way too, because if police interview somebody, they don't have to give them Miranda warnings.
To this day, the Italian police claim that my own interrogation was not an interrogation at all, but merely an interview. That I wasn't a suspect, and thus that I wasn't entitled to a lawyer or a translator or the equivalent of U.S. Miranda rights. According to them, I was free to leave the entire time. It sure didn't feel that way when I was surrounded by half a dozen cops in a small room who were yelling at me and slapping me in the middle of the night. According to the police, the statements I signed were spontaneous declarations, freely given, after 53 hours of questioning over 5 days, in which I'd repeatedly denied any knowledge of the crime.
But that's not to say that those police were intentionally trying to get an innocent girl to confess. Rather, they'd engaged in some pseudoscientific behavior analysis of Amanda during their initial questioning, which led them to believe that she was lying to them about something. They then shifted her into a guilt-presumptive process driven at obtaining a confession, all the while believing they were getting closer and closer to the truth.
So one of the questions I always come to grips with is, what did he know? Did he know better than this, or was this some innocent kind of mistake? And I always default to innocent mistake. The problem with police is they're human. And humans are imperfect. You know, we form a strong belief and we proceed to pursue information in light of that belief. Imagine you're a police officer, you bring in a suspect, and you're absolutely convinced, for whatever reason, that that suspect committed this crime. Now you start questioning the suspect. Now, according to their training, you're not supposed to feed information about the crime to the suspect. You're waiting for the suspect to give you those facts to prove that they know the facts of the crime. And yet, even detectives trained in that withhold information tactic, even those trained, go ahead and communicate information about the crime. But think about it. They bring in someone, they're absolutely convinced this is the guy. That means they think he knows all the facts. I'm not telling him anything he doesn't already know. He's the criminal. So they're not doing something nefarious in their mind. They're simply having a conversation. You know, when you have a conversation with someone, you don't start from scratch. You start from where the two of you know that you left off. And if in fact you believe that this person is the criminal, well, okay, then we can take for granted that you know certain things.
A 2010 study published in the Stanford Law Review looked at 38 cases of DNA-proven false confessions and found that 94% of them contained details that supposedly only the perpetrator could have known. meaning those confessions must have been contaminated by police knowledge, whether through leading questions, evidence photos, or escorted visits to crime scenes.
There's a detective who is a friend of mine, James Tranum, who wrote a whole book on false confessions and wrote an article in Police Chief magazine. I forget the title, but you know, something like, "Don't tell me false confessions don't happen. I took one." He's a great guy. He wouldn't have done this on purpose. But someone he got to confess to a murder was exonerated. And he went back and reviewed the tape of the interrogation because he was working for the DC Metro Police and they required recording. He went back and looked at the recording because he was confused. He kept thinking, she knew stuff. How could she be innocent? And he went back over the tape and realized in reviewing it that he gave her all those facts. Those facts all sourced to him. He didn't do it on purpose. He wouldn't have done it on purpose. But that's kind of human nature. And believe it or not, a student of mine and I took that into the lab and found exactly that. With forget police. We did it with participants in an experiment. When they believe somebody knows something, they start communicating those facts. So it's hard for me to know sometimes at what point it's nefarious and at what point it's just human nature.
The same goes for John E. Reed himself. Remember Daryl Parker, the man Reed got to confess to killing his wife? A confession that bolstered Reed's reputation and the validity of his psychological interrogation technique? Well, in 1988, a man named Wesley Peary died inside a Nebraska penitentiary. Only then were his lawyers no longer bound by attorney-client privilege, and they revealed the memoir manuscript Peary had given to them, which included a detailed account of how he had raped and killed Daryl Parker's wife.
He was even a suspect at the time, but once John Reed got Daryl Parker to confess, it was case closed, and Wesley Peary was free to go on committing other crimes. He raped and assaulted a pregnant woman and eventually wound up on death row for the execution-style murder of a shop owner. It wasn't until 1991, 36 years after his wife was killed, that Daryl Parker was pardoned. And it wasn't until 2011 that the state acknowledged him as perhaps the first in the Reed Technique's long list of innocent victims.
Stay tuned for the next episode of False Confessions. It could happen to you, where we'll look at all the risk factors that lead innocent people to confess.
In the meantime, get lost with us. Find us on X, at Amanda Knox.
At Man Under Bridge.
On Instagram, at Amama Knox.
At MC Carbon.
You can learn more about our work and how to support it at amandaknox.com. And let me ask you a question. Are you going to leave us a 5-star review because we asked you to, or because Labyrinths is just that good?
False Confessions, a Labyrinths miniseries, is brought to you by Knox Robinson Productions. This episode was written and produced by us, along with our managing producer, Andre Sapp, and our production assistant, Charlie Darnell. Our theme music is by Josh Budo Karp.